When the singer Solange Knowles chopped off her hair and let it go natural, it was a big deal. She had to defend her afro against critics, and that inspired women of color to start talking about their hair and the decision to go through an intense straightening regimen or have their natural hair seen as some kind of statement.
I have naturally curly hair, but throughout the years, I always straightened it, you know, I blow dry it, I put a, you know, a hot comb to it.
There is a ton of pressure on Black women to treat their hair. Chris Rock made a whole movie about it, a documentary called Good Hair, inspired by a question his young daughter asked him.
Just yesterday, my daughter came into the house and said, "Daddy, how come I don't have good hair? I wonder how she came up with that idea."
The pressure to change who you are and how you look can be felt by a young child. That's really sad, and a Kansas City artist is trying to change it. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about hair as an important symbol of identity when it comes to not just race, but also gender and a whole host of other things. Let's start with race. Shavana Adams is creator of a coloring book called I Love My Hair. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
That's I Love My Hair with an exclamation point.
That's correct.
Each image is of a different person, most of them people getting their hair done. Tell me about the people in the pictures, what they look like.
So I wanted to reflect images that are some that I may see when I go into the barbershop or beauty shop. So they're mainly Black and brown people, but I wanted someone that I may be sitting next to when I go in to get my hair done.
This is interesting to me that it's about race, mm-hmm. but because it's a coloring book, the one thing that you haven't used to communicate race is skin tone, because the images have not been colored in yet.
That's right.
Can you talk to me about that?
I wanted this coloring book to reflect everyone, even children that are not of not a minority status. So I wanted to leave it all inclusive.
And just open-ended.
That's right.
But how do you get, can you talk to me about your techniques for portraying a diversity of hair and a diversity of people without using color to do it?
That's right. It's in the texture of the hair. The styles are indicative of people of color, particularly one page where the young lady has a huge afro, the pics. So I wanted to use the symbols of our hair, but not necessarily lean toward the tones or the skin color.
So when you think of the pic as a symbol, can you talk mm-hmm. to me about that?
Well, you talk about the 70s, the 60s, the civil rights movement, where people of color moved more towards the bold afro look, the pick with the fist. It made a social statement, and I'm all about making sure to include social subjects into my art. So I wanted to make sure that that image, that bold image, emboldened children too.
What gave you the idea for this book? What made you want to do this in the first place?
Well, my barbershop is located off 39th and Main, and I was sitting in my barber chair. The shop gives away literature to children while they're getting their hair done, or their parents are in the chair. And I told my barber, I said, wouldn't it be neat if the kids had something to color while they're here, particularly surrounding a barbershop theme? He thought it was amazing. And so from that, I Love My Hair was born.
How do you feel about your own hair? Have you been on a sort of a journey with your relationship with your hair?
I have. My hair goes everywhere with me. And so I'm also a singer, a performer here in Kansas City, Missouri. There are times where I may wear wigs and stage performance, but right now I've chosen the short natural look. It's just bold, and that's how I see myself. So
what does it feel like to you?
Well, I get a lot of compliments, as low as it actually is, and it's surprising, but
yeah, it's cut very close to the skin.
Absolutely. And I have, you know, the designs on the side right now and things like that. But to me, it just shows that I'm proud of myself, my heritage. A lot of times African-American women in particular lean more towards processing their hair or using extensions. And for myself, I just wanted to be natural and be proud of my heritage.
Do you remember as a kid your own ideas just before you would have been old enough to be inclined to like intellectualize them. Do you remember your own impressions of different kind of hair and what they meant?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, regrettably, in our community, particularly, we're told that the textures of our hair are negative status. You know, they use negative connotations like nappy or, you know, bad hair, those kinds of things. And so growing up as a African-American child, you're more prone to straightening your hair or coloring it lighter or those types of things. So what I wanted to do with the book is to show children, start young, that it's okay to be, you know, have curly hair or wear dreads or braids, that those things are good. And, you know, that's what I wanted to make sure they knew.
You've said your hair goes with you everywhere. Mm-hmm. I am interested in that. The idea of this relationship between hair and identity, which on some level, hair is totally superficial, but it's also one of the first things people might notice. And then one of the first things they might reference in trying to describe you if you're going to be like in a crowd and someone's looking for you. Unlike a lot of other things about our appearance, though, we have some control over our hair. Not total control, but we do have choices to make.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about just hair as identity or hair as like just the same as anything else about your appearance?
You have to be willing to embrace it. I talked a little bit about in my community and the negative portions of, you have to look a certain way, a certain industry standard, a certain industry look. And particularly for me as a performer, I decided that I wanted to go outside the box and be myself. And when I say it goes with me, people kind of know me for my looks, my hair, when I hit the stage or when I'm doing a photo shoot or a video shoot. So I have to be proud of it. I have to embrace it. And that comes along with learning who I am as an African-American woman. I had to do a lot of research with this book as to what images I think kids would hold on to and grasp to that would look like them. And I think I did a good job.
I think you did a good job, too. I want to bring our next guest in on this. Kate Van Vleck is a hairstylist and also a co-founder of a new salon called Him, Her, Them. And Kate, why don't you describe your salon and the reason why it exists?
Hi. So we opened Him, Her, Them Hair Studio. We're actually coming up on our second year anniversary, which is super exciting. Me and my business partner, Jaren, we've both been doing hair for me 10 years, him about 15. And I think you said earlier, can't take your hair with you. That's one of like the biggest things. It's the accessory you can't take off. And I think a lot of hairstylists will agree with that. And we've noticed we're also very involved in the LGBT community here in Kansas City. and hair is one of the first things that you're going to describe somebody with. It's also for people who are gender nonconforming or in the process of transitioning. It's something that we absolutely can control. And one of the first things to really start shifting the way someone might perceive us and to make our outward appearance match what we feel and who we are on the inside. And so I think the biggest thing with us was having a safe place to have this, and because hair, when you look at a price menu at a salon, you see women's cuts and men's cuts. And a huge thing is your beautiful short hair in any, not any salon, but many salons you'd walk into, I would cut as a shortcut, but some other salon might charge it as a women's cut, and there's a huge price variance there, which for something that we like to focus on, the amount of time a service would take or what's involved in the service. And so a big thing for us was taking the gender out of our price menu.
Yeah, and that is super interesting that just in a very literal way, if you're going to call yourself a woman, you're going to pay for your hair, you know, in that way.
And many are paying for in that. Stereotypically, it's a long haircut is what you're thinking. And that's just not the case anymore. And so I just think it's important to have that reflected in our menu.
On some level, is it about what a salon is? I guess I'm interested in the need for a place like Him, Her, Them. Is this what you might call the standard issue salon experience, something that can be daunting in a particular way for some people in the queer community?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually the other big thing for us is we've both worked in salons where people have come in and especially trans folks who just, it's a huge, scary time in your life of trying to really make who you are seen and valued. And the biggest thing is I don't want anyone to ever come in somewhere and feel like they can't be exactly who they are. You can have short hair or long hair or green hair or black hair or any kind of hair. But a lot of times I think people feel like if they sit down and they're perceived to maybe need to have long hair by someone else's standards, that they can't ask for short hair or vice versa. And so it was really important that I want your hair to feel and be just like how you want it to feel and be.
When you first go to a stylist, just in general, it is this, and I'm talking about a new stylist, someone you don't know yet, it is this very odd experience of handing over something as personal as your style to someone who doesn't know you. And you have to hope that they're going to get you and what you want pretty quickly before any scissors come out, which is awkward. But there's also this other piece of it that it's very intimate. Getting a haircut, someone's touching your head. Someone's very much in your personal space. So giving yourself over to that, you really have to feel safe. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. It is really scary because you have no idea what you're walking into or what this person might think or feel themselves. And I know that I am lucky enough every day I go into work, I very rarely feel like I'm at work, and I feel like it's because I really like to get to know my clients. I know as somebody sitting down, you might have shown up in this chair for a referral or just because you needed a haircut. But I think it's really important to, as a stylist communicating with specifically a new client, to really sit down and ask questions. I like to sit down and like in front of my client actually and talk a little bit about what they like or what they don't like, and specifically, you know, what has or hasn't worked in the past. And so for me, not just you leaving that day feeling and looking great, but me being able to explain how to achieve this look on your own at home and finding something that fits with you so you feel great about yourself and your hair every time that you're styling it and working with it.
What are some stories that people have told you about their experiences in other salons and why they might not have felt totally like the intended clientele?
I think one of the most common things that that we tend to hear, and specifically from clients who are transgender, is that the stylist may seem to have a preconceived notion of how to do a particular style, specifically when it comes to a person who is presenting as female or who is female choosing to have a shortcut. A lot of people feel as though it's then cut in a very masculine way or maybe we don't do short, like this is how you should wear it this way, because this style may be seen as too masculine. But even if you're female and you're wanting a shortcut, there's just such a huge range of masculine to feminine styles that it doesn't matter how you,
you're doing great
all the time. But it just, I feel like the most common thing we do get generally tends to revolve around short hair and looking masculine or feminine and how that correlates to that person's identity.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're off to a break. Call 816-235-2888 to share your story about hair, identity, acceptance, the whole package on KCUR Central Standard. That number again is 816-235-2888. When we return, how sensitivity around hair and race became an issue for him, her, them on Facebook, and what the salon learned from that. Plus, an expert on hair and identity joins the discussion. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about hair. Shavonna Adams is here. She's the author of a new coloring book called I Love My Hair to help kids of color in particular embrace their hair as it is. Shavonna, hello.
Hi, Gina. How you doing?
Good. And we are also joined by the co-founder of a new salon created as a safe space for the queer community. It's called Him, Her, Them. Kate Van Vleck. Hello again.
Hi.
Call 816-235-2888 to tell your story of how someone getting or not getting your particular identity has become an issue for you in getting a haircut. 816-235-2888. So, Kate, something happened on the Facebook page for Him, Her, Them. I think it was in March. The salon shared a photo of a new stylist, a white woman with dreadlocks. And that image combined with the absence of people of color on staff, or at least a perception that there was that absence, made some people feel really uncomfortable with the idea that this is a salon that can be seen as a safe space for everyone. Can you first of all explain, as best you understand it, what the stylist with dreads, what about that image offended people?
Absolutely. It was actually, this whole experience was such a huge eye-opening, like, blind spot that, like, really needed to be addressed and made aware to us. Dreads, I personally have known that dreads and dreads on white people is absolutely a sensitive issue. And it, as it relates to the situation, I really was, and I feel like I can't apologize really enough for kind of what happened, because I was aware, and it just really went straight up and over my head, and I truly didn't think about how it would affect people that see us or people that we serve. But that dreads are just such a huge cultural, the roots and where it comes from, and to have one set of people not be allowed to wear hair because of a skin color, but then to have my stylist, who is a white woman, and then it in my eyes or our eyes to be seen as edgy, how incorrect and how wrong, and to have that be brought to our attention. I'm really grateful that people did bring it to our attention so we could handle that and to become better. And there's never too safe of a space to have.
The comments under that photo were really, for me to read those, I was affected by them. You know, there was one gentleman who he was expressing that he had been interested in perhaps coming to your salon as a place where his relationship with masculinity might be understood, but then that this whole conversation that unfolded made him wonder if there was going to be anyone there who would get his hair and would, you know what I'm saying? It was really, to read his personal dilemma really drove a lot of what we're talking about today home for me.
Absolutely. There were so many different comments, and it was kind of hard to keep up with a lot of the comments, and they were very overwhelming. I think maybe the important thing that I took away from a lot of this is, even though I want my space to be the safest place for anybody, but that only goes as far as somebody can see it. And so I think we're always working as human beings to grow and to learn more. I can't always understand everything, but I'm always willing to learn more and to listen and to take the advice and the experiences of other people. And so for anyone that saw any of that, you know, I'm always open ears and open heart to any suggestions to be made to become a safer space and to make sure that everybody feels that and feels comfortable coming in our door.
Shivana, I want to bring you back in on this. Does this speak to some of the complexity of how hair converges with all kinds of aspects of race, even when not everyone can even see that it's part of that conversation?
Absolutely. One of the things you spoke about earlier is how I was able to create a coloring book where we were able to identify the ethnicity in a person without the color of their skin. Well, a lot of it is in the styles of the hair. And as an African-American woman, I can speak to that. We hold our hair dear to us. My grandmother would, you know, sit us down in the kitchen and we'd have those moments where she'd, you know, do our hair. And it was very intimate moment with your family, your friends, you know, the barbershop is, we hold those areas near and dear to us. It's a time where we learn about politics and community and what's going on with each other. So our hair, we, you know, we identify that as heritage, as part of us, particularly dreads, particularly the afro. Those are some styles that we readily identify as ours. And right or wrong, I don't know necessarily if we can claim that, you know, particularly your stylist. If she was able to dread her hair, obviously that's something that she held dear to her own identity. And so I don't necessarily say that it's fair that we just snatch that from her, but maybe to educate her as to how important it is to us. And, you know, and then she can feel where we're coming from or even appreciate our heritage in her style.
When you earlier said that you did a lot of research before working on this coloring book, can you talk about the research you did about the afro, about dreads?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at different coloring books from different countries, actually, particularly in Africa. They actually do some similar things in their shops where they depict pictures of hairstyles and color. And so they have beautiful artwork. And I really, really, truly was inspired. Also, a lady by the name of Julia Cole, I'm working with the Charlotte Street Foundation. I'm one of their sponsored artists right now. And she brought over back to me from England a postcard from an artist. And I was able to see some depictions there of their styles and things like that. So I really had to go outside the box, not lean necessarily towards African-American, like as Americanized our styles. I wanted to kind of see a broader picture around the world of how we identify with our hair.
Was there something that you saw in one of those images that really was eye-opening to you?
It was just interesting as to some of the similarities, actually, to some of the styles that we have. I did like that. A lot of the male styles are similar to the male styles here. The female styles were more braids and beads that I found as opposed to our more relaxed curls here. But other than that, the male styles were, they mirrored each other.
I want to bring in a national guest. Elizabeth Benedict is the editor of a book called Me, My Hair, and I, 27 Women Untangle an Obsession. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
What are you?
I'm really enjoying this conversation. I could listen all day.
I was just going to ask you, what are you hearing that we might not, as someone who has really like gone deep with 27 different people about their own relationships with their hair?
Well, it's interesting. My brain is just sort of firing on a lot of ideas and memories, but it's one of the, there's an essay in this book by Marita Golden, an African-American writer, called My Black Hair. And it's kind of one of, I don't like to pick favorites in my books of essays among other writers, but in this case, it's kind of an easy favorite because it's like an 11-page history of the central issues regarding African-American women and their hair in a historic sense. And it's a really powerful essay. And it's about Marita's own hair, but also some of the things that Shivana has been talking about, the kitchen, the storytelling, the role of identity and communication and learning about your heritage in African-American communities.
What about the gender piece of it? Because it's interesting to me that it's 27 women untangling an obsession. And we do, I think, culturally tend to think of hair as a women's obsession. But as we've been hearing from Kate, everyone, well, not everyone has hair, but everyone has a presentation of hair to make, even if that means not having hair and choosing to wear a wig. We all have some choice there. What do you think is the gendered thing about this?
Well, this book was conceived and started, the idea for it was in 2013, I believe, and it came out in 2015. And so, but I asked people to write starting in 2013, which is now 6 years ago. And some of the issues that the that you've been talking about with the new salon, him, her, they, them, these are fairly recent issues, or they've become much more dramatic and much more in the mainstream in the last two years. And so
bigger part of the public conversation.
Yeah. And when this book was started and conceived of, these issues were a little more marginal to the conversation. And I thought about them. And I think I didn't quite have the, I mean, they weren't so pressing. And if I were going to redo the book now, it would definitely be a much, these would be much more central, right? Or they would be part of the conversation. They weren't so much part of the national conversation when people talked about hair. And it was much easier. And to be fair, the hair care industry does focus on women. The majority of the money in the hair care industry, which is like billions of dollars, is about women and girls. And there may be other parts of it, but the main money is about women. And if you look at women's magazines, women's newspapers, magazines, TV advertising, it's about women and their hair. And so just as a and the fact that there's now a beauty salon called Him, Her, Them, I think it's fantastic. But it's newsworthy, right? Because it's not they're not everywhere. And so I think it's fantastic, and it's part of the evolving conversation about transgender and gender fluidity and issues like that. But that is very much an evolving issue, Kate, in terms of hair.
Kate, jump in.
sorry. I will agree that over the past few years, salon money that's spent towards the industry is highly focused on women. I think they're missing out on a huge market by highly focusing there. And, you know, I think our main goal is not necessarily focusing on one gender or another, but just that that everybody, even if it's the simplest of haircuts all the way to the most elaborate color extension processing situation, that everyone is making sure their outside is reflective of who they are on the inside.
Let's talk to Pam. Pam is calling us from Kansas City at 816-235-2888. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to comment to see if your guest had a perspective on ageism and the pressure that older women may face about coloring their hair, and whether or not you're viewed as being, vibrant or relevant and that sort of thing.
Tell your story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm completely gray now. And I love it, but I probably colored my hair for 30 or 40 decades, and just that transition of no longer coloring my hair and then viewing myself as, oh, I'm so old and I'm no longer attractive or relevant, and just wanted to see what your speakers thought about that.
This is something that I took on in Me, My Hair, and I, and I had two opposing views on coloring hair versus not coloring. And in the process, I handed in the book, and then I went to a guy who colored my hair black when it had never been black. And when he did that, I gave up coloring my hair because I didn't want to go through the money and the indignity of having to go, as they say, go back to coloring my hair.
Wait, Elizabeth, can you tell that story in a little more detail? You went to someone to have gray covered up. Is that right?
I colored my hair for 20 years. And I went one day because it was my husband's birthday. And I only sort of I only kind of do my hair on special occasions because I work at home, and so I went and had this, and I said, you know, color my hair the way you did like 2 months ago. And he screwed up and made my hair like shoe polish black. And I was just horrified. And my hair was dark brown. But, you know, it's a big difference. And it was, and also as you get older, as you know, it's better to have lighter hair than darker just because of dry skin and all that stuff. So anyway, that night, I just said, I'm through coloring my hair. Because in order to get your hair back to lighter shades, it's like a half a year process, and you have to do highlights. You can't just undo it. It's not like, you know, washing dirty clothes. It's a very elaborate and expensive process. And it must be said that dark hair dye is increasingly understood to be possibly very dangerous. It's also bad for the environment. And so this had all been on my mind for a long time. And at that point, I just said, I'm finished. That's it.
Can you talk about why you had been coloring your hair for, you said, about 20 years?
Yeah, because I wanted to look young. And just like the caller said, she struggled with, you know, feeling old and looking old. I'm still embarrassed that I have gray hair. I sort of hate my hair. I wish I could have beautiful brown hair like I used to have. And I sort of apologize sometimes to people, like when they talk to me and on the phone or on Skype, and then I say, oh yeah, I'm sorry about my gray hair. I mean, I still don't like it and I still don't wish I had it, but I am not willing to put all this chemicals in my hair for the rest of the rest of time. And I also think it's a very sensitive issue. And in terms of the book that I wrote, Me, My Hair, and I, it was sort of the most controversial issue, because it really touches on aging and self-image, and we're all going to get there if we live long enough.
You know what else it touches on that I think isn't, not to discount any of that, because I think that's absolutely true. It also touches on the identity we have already put for however many decades into having a certain color of hair, because I identify so strongly with being a brunette that has, especially I grew up in an environment with a lot of blonde people. And so having brown hair and up until a certain point in my life, having brown hair and choosing not to do anything about that, as you know what I mean? That is, I identify very strongly with that. And so my feelings about this gray hair issue have a lot more in some ways to do with not being ready to let go of being a brunette.
I think that, you know, like all the conversation we've been having, whether it's about gender, whether it's about race, this whole gray hair thing is really touchy and complicated, and it's really tied up with our identity. And I live in New York City. And I also have lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, you know, as a general rule, it's fine not to dye your hair in Cambridge. But in New York, like, you wouldn't be caught dead without dyed hair.
That's,
you know,
so funny.
I mean, so, and it has to do with, and like, if you're in West Los Angeles, you're going to dye your hair, right? I mean, it's all about being youthful and staying young and looking young and doing whatever you can to look young. You know, and these are major issues, that have to do with health.
Elizabeth, I want to jump in and ask Kate about this, because coloring hair is part of what you do. And I have noticed you color hair every color of the rainbow, and very proudly color hair every color of the rainbow. I'm interested in, hair color as part of a person's identity and how that's changing, because I think the range of options that are considered somewhat mainstream has grown. I also have seen some women really rocking some very stylish gray or white hair, and to the point that I'm like, I want it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Color is my absolute favorite thing. It's what I specialize in. And for me, years ago in a salon I worked at, it was just someone would call up and say, I want an all-over color. I want a highlight. And it gets slapped on the books with like this hour and a half window, and I don't know anything about somebody who's coming in or what they're wanting. And over the years, I have changed that process in how I handle my clients. When someone gets a hold of me, I really want to see what your hair looks like currently. What do you like or not like about it? What are your goals in the future? And also how that works within your lifestyle, including budget, things, maybe swimming. There's all kinds of things that affect our color and how much we have to maintain or what we need to do to keep it healthy and shiny. And I have lots of clients actually that rock the gray and the silver. And while I absolutely love doing color, I absolutely love the beauty of my clients' natural hair or just the hair that they want. I mean, I think there are so many options in having gray hair and having your natural hair without having to put any sort of color on it. There are things that we can do as far as just keeping the vibrancy, and maybe that's changing up some shampoos and conditioners or some different products to help give it that lustrous, like youthful shine, and to make it shiny and sparkly. And I just think ultimately the color doesn't, in my opinion, I don't feel like I see age with color. I just see a happy person. So however that equates and makes the client happy is like, if we're doing green or orange or red, awesome. If we're keeping it natural, let's keep it natural. And I just think there's beauty in all of that.
Shavana, does race affect this conversation about hair color and aging and all of that?
Well, it does play a part. We'll talk about heritage. My great-grandfather, he lived to be 102, and he had the most beautiful platinum, like white gray hair. And so I'm personally looking forward to going all gray, all white. You know, I just cannot wait to get there. My grandmother, who passed away in November, she was 95, and she still had a little salt and pepper look to her. It was so cute. It was a nice, you know, blend. And so seeing them embrace who they were and it being a part of the images of the people that I loved in my life. I have a little gray going on in the front, and you know, sometimes I've picked a few of them. I'm not gonna, you know, pretend that I haven't, but for the most part, I'm
a couple of gray hairs, yeah, is much different than a whole head.
Absolutely.
That just is like, what's going on there?
Correct. Yeah. But I've actually stopped that process and started to embrace kind of what's going on with me going into age 40 coming up soon. And so I'm starting to be okay with who I am.
Shavana Adams, thank you so much.
Absolutely, thank you.
Kate Van Vleck, thank you.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Benedict, thank you.
Thank you.
Keep telling your hair stories. You can do it on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Next, a conversation with the artist who did the brightly colored lobby installation at the Kemper Museum. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and our next guest is Paul Henry Ramirez. He's an artist, and the bright colors that pop on the white walls as you enter the Kemper Museum right now were his vision. In his artist statement, he says he's trying to talk about the way our bodies elicit joy, one of our most sought-after emotions, and we are going to talk to him about that right now. Paul Henry Ramirez, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. This piece in the lobby, it's called Sweet On. Tell me about it.
Well, Sweet On embraces a mixture and sophistication of fun, which invites the viewer to be surrounded by an immersive environment, you know, of joy and beauty. So I really want to embrace the viewers as they come into the space to look at a beautiful color and just really feel a part of what's going on in the space.
You know, joy is such, I will call it a buzzword in our culture right now, but in the art world, to talk, and especially in either conceptual art or abstract art, to talk about things like beauty and joy, that has been kind of, I feel like artists have avoided that for a long time. And I'm interested in your embrace of the idea that this is about beauty and joy.
Well, you know, over the past, let's say, two decades, I've really embraced beauty in my artwork. I really intentionally, you know, sought after bringing that into my work, and it's just something that I decided to do back, you know, two decades ago. I just felt that it was just a great way to connect with people. It's kind of a universal language. And
beauty is.
Beauty is and joy.
Yeah.
Beauty is in the way you look at beauty. And beauty can, you know, it could be, it's the eye of the beholder, right? So beauty can, you can look at a beautiful flower, and as it dies and withers away, it's still just as beautiful in the way it passes. So there's lots of forms of beauty.
What does joy mean to you?
Well, joy is coming into, let's just say, Sweet On at Kemper Museum of Art, and just really coming into an environment that really makes you feel good. It's uplifting. It just really touches you in a very positive way, and then you can walk away from it and remember that, wow, you know, that installation, that show did something, it gave me something. And I think that's, it's an uplifting, happy feeling, joyous. And that's how I kind of perceive my work there at Kemper Museum.
Can we talk about your own path to being someone who does installations in art museums, and also someone who grew up and came to have this particular understanding of joy and beauty? You grew up in El Paso. Can you tell me about your childhood and how you got into art?
Sure. You know, I was born in El Paso, Texas, and raised and born a border city of Juarez, Mexico. And ever since I was a young kid, a little kid, I've always wanted to be an artist. And I think that really came from looking at a family Bible that we had with beautiful pictures. And I remember studying and looking at all the pictures and thinking, boy, I'd like to do that, learn how to do that. And as I got older and in grade school, I was pretty talented in making things and creating works for school projects, and would get complimented. And that kind of really enforced my moving forward with investigating this whole idea of becoming an artist.
Can I back up to that Bible?
Sure.
When I don't know what your family Bible looked like, but when I picture a Bible and the artwork in it, the first thing that comes to mind is the way sometimes in biblical art, sun rays kind of separate and beam down on people.
Yes. Well, the Bible we had was just a little, it was a small Bible, but it had beautiful illustrations, very beautiful paintings of the stories. And I would examine the way the images looked, and how each image was different by different artists, so it just had a different. So it studied the sky, or the way the clothing, the shadows, and just was just very curious about how that was done, and I just couldn't believe that someone actually painted these works. So I was really intrigued by that.
What was your path beyond being this kid who was excelling in art and people were talking about, you know, good job, you're great at this? What was your path to New York? And you ended up doing windows at Macy's when you first arrived there.
That's right. Well, first I went to school at the University of Texas at El Paso, where I studied art. And then I received some funding to go to school to study printmaking in Paris. And at the time, this is like in the early 80s, a good friend of mine was living in the East Coast, and I called him up and said, hey, you know, I'm going to Paris to study printmaking. And then he had said, well, why don't you come visit here? And maybe you might like to stay, because, you know, and you've always wanted to come to New York. And so I kind of decided, well, should I go to Paris, the East Coast? And I always wanted to go to the East Coast. And so I did that. And I came and I did the visit, and I actually stayed in here in New Jersey, where he lived, and that's how my life began almost 3 decades ago from El Paso. And shortly after arriving to the East Coast, I was looking for work, and I worked for Macy's department store at you know, one of the malls here in New Jersey, and then. Would then work for Lord & Taylor in these places. So my background has always been in the visual merchandising aspect. Even when I was living in El Paso, I worked for a family-owned department store called The Popular. And right after high school, when I went to apply for a job there, I was really applying for a graphics design position, doing illustrations for the local newspaper, because I really The only thing that was really opened was this visual display position. So they asked if I'd like to do that. I said, sure. So that really opened a lot of doors for me, just working there for doing the displays or the popular, and then coming to New York's the East Coast and giving them a little of that information at the pop at Macy's gave me that job there at Macy's and at Lauren Taylor. And then shortly after that, I went to New York City to visit Bendel's on Fifth Avenue because one of my instructors at Raritan Valley Community College had recommended that I go visit the store. It had just moved to the Fifth Avenue location on Fifth Avenue. And so I took, you know, the subway out there and just really wanted to see what it looked like. And it was just such a great store. I'd asked one of the guys who was dressing a mannequin if they were hiring and taking applications, and he said, sure, yeah, we are. And he gave me the name of the manager, and I sent her a letter. And shortly after, I was interviewed for the job and started designing windows for 3 years for Bendel's on Fifth Avenue. And my first window was for Jean-Paul Gaultier, designing kind of a celebration opening of the store.
When I think about what a window display is in someone's pedestrian experience, that it is, well, actually, I don't want to know what I think about it. I want to know what you think. I mean, as someone who has done this, how do you think about the role that this window has in the life of the person walking by? There's a part of it that is about sales, but there is a part of it you have to, of course, recognize that the vast majority of people are just going to walk by.
Right. Well, you know, Bendel's is was a kind of a specialty boutique store, so it was pretty avant-garde as far as they're very progressive and alternative as far as the way our windows were designed, and we carried a lot of very well-known contemporary fashion designers like Jean-Paul Gaultier and Claude Montana and Anna Sui, and so our windows were really pretty fun, you know. And so in itself, it was just each window was like an art piece. And it was just to bring attention to the viewer as they pass by and see such just an opulent, beautiful environment and what we created for viewers passing by. That was something that we would, you know, was something we would try to accomplish. And we also had other stores to compete with. So we had Bergdorf Goodman and we have Tiffany's and, you know, we had.
So you had to like one up their windows.
Well, yeah, you know, every window's beautiful. You know, everybody did beautiful installations, just great, great, you know, window designs. And so I think, you know, just being surrounded by beauty in a store like Bendel's and working with beautiful materials, Karl Lagerfeld and the beautiful garments that he would create, I would study the stitching, you know, just the way they made these clothes. It's a work of art, really. And so my life has always been around and this, you know, these beautiful materials and goods. So maybe somehow that kind of filtered into my work a little. But
yeah, I guess I'm wondering about that. You have this this ability to embrace at face value the idea of putting beauty in the world and helping people feel joy, which I feel like is not the sort of standard art world conversation. And I wonder if your experience doing those window displays was, in a sense, your training about that.
Can you rephrase that a little bit so I can understand?
Yeah, just how do you think that your experience doing window displays has influenced your ideas about beauty and joy and art?
Oh, well, I think that because I've done, you know, working with environments like window displays and just getting, you know, learning and getting appreciating space and the way viewers see space and come into space, I kind of take that into my own work, you know, how viewers come into a space and see the artwork in the space. And so, and along with beauty, it's also punctuated with the body. So it's very layered with a lot of different elements in the artwork. So first you see the beauty and the joy of it, but it also speaks about the body and the celebration of the body and who we are as individuals, whether you're straight or gay or and a different race.
Yeah. Paul Henry, we have to go. Yeah. I'm so sorry, but Paul Henry Ramirez, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Paul Henry Ramirez has done the installation Sweet On at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art. And that's a wrap for today's show. Tomorrow, with the world changing as fast as it is and accepted wisdom not always applying anymore, how do grown-ups offer advice to high school grads? That's tomorrow, and we hope you'll chime in. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.